Hey there, history lovers! This is Lumi coming at you with another episode that's gonna blow your mind! Today we're diving into Pitt Meadows, British Columbia, and oh my god, do I have some stories for you! So picture this, it's 1914, and there's this tiny little farming community of less than 250 people just trying to make it work. But here's the kicker, they keep getting absolutely destroyed by floods. Like seriously, Mother Nature was not having it with these folks. The Fraser River flood of 1894 just straight up said nope to their whole situation and flooded acres and acres of their land. But did they give up? Absolutely not. And can we talk about how this place got its name? They named it after William Pitt the Younger. You know, the British Prime Minister. Imagine being so important that a whole Canadian city gets named after you. Although, honestly, if I had a nickel for every place named after some random British politician, I'd have enough money to buy my own town. But anyway, here's where it gets really fascinating. Indigenous peoples had been living there for about 1,000 years before Europeans even showed up. 1,000 years! That's like 50 generations of people calling this place home. Then James McMillan rolls up in 1824 for the Hudson's Bay Company expedition, and boom, everything changes. But wait, it gets better. So these early settlers were mostly Anglo-Saxon until 1910. But then after 1910, French Canadians and Japanese people started arriving. Then after World War II, and this is my favorite part, a massive group of Dutch farmers showed up and basically said, "Hold my beer," to the flooding problem. They reclaimed all this low-lying land like absolute legends. Speaking of World War II, Pitt Meadows lost some brave servicemen, including aircraftman Second Class William George Benn, ordinary seaman John Pastorek, and Flight Lieutenant Robert Arnold Samuel Lasser. These guys deserve to be remembered, and honestly, that's exactly why I love history. It's about real people with real stories. Now here's something that'll make you go, "Wait, what?" Pitt Lake, which is right there in Pitt Meadows, is the largest freshwater tidal lake in the world, like the actual world. How is that not in every geography textbook ever? The Pitt River literally flows backwards at high tide. Backwards. Nature is absolutely wild, you guys. And speaking of wild, this place is basically a flood zone waiting to happen. 68% of it is in a floodplain, but they've got 64 kilometers of dikes protecting everything. That's like having a giant protective hug around your entire city, except the hug is made of dirt and engineering. Here's something that made me laugh. In 2018, a bus stop in Pitt Meadows got voted the sorriest bus stop in America by Streets Blog. Like, imagine that competition. And the award for most depressing place to wait for public transportation goes to... I mean, at least they won something, right? But seriously, this place has grown from that tiny farming community to almost 20,000 people today. The demographic breakdown is fascinating. You've got European Canadians, East Asians, Southeast Asians, South Asians, Indigenous peoples, Middle Eastern folks, Latin Americans, Africans. It's like the whole world decided to move to this one spot in British Columbia and create something amazing together. Oh, and get this, 86% of the land is still in the Agricultural Land Reserve, which means it's protected farmland. They've got cranberry farms, blueberry farms, greenhouses growing specialty peppers and cut flowers. There's even this place called the Meadows Maze, which is one of the largest corn mazes in the Pacific Northwest. Imagine getting lost in corn for fun. The movie connections are pretty cool, too. They filmed parts of Happy Gilmore there, some Smallville scenes, and even parts of Duets with Gwyneth Paltrow. Not bad for a farming community, right? And here's your fun fact to impress people at parties. Pitt Meadows is home to notable residents like hockey player Brendan Morrison, actress Molly Parker, and musician Devin Townsend, plus writer Mike Kubat, who probably has some amazing stories about growing up there. So there you have it, folks. Pitt Meadows, where 1,000 years of indigenous history meets Dutch flood management, where backwards flowing rivers create the world's largest freshwater tidal lake, and where a community of 250 farmers grew into a diverse city of 20,000 people who refused to let a little flooding stop their dreams. That's all for today's History Hour. I'm Lumi, reminding you that history isn't just about dates and names. It's about real people doing incredible things. Until next time, keep exploring! Hey there, history lovers! It's your girl, Lumi, coming at you live, and oh my gosh, do I have the most amazing story for you today! So, like, you know how I'm totally obsessed with finding these hidden gems in Japanese history? Well, I just discovered this place that literally made me squeal with excitement. Picture this. There's this town in Japan called Kanyi, and get this, it's the only place in the entire country with crab in its name. Like, seriously? There used to be another one called Kaneda, but it got merged away in 2005, making Kanyi the ultimate crab champion. How cool is that? But wait, it gets better. This place is basically Japan's version of Venice, except instead of being all fancy European, it's got this super unique below sea level vibe going on. Like, the entire town is literally sitting at 0 meters above sea level. Can you imagine? They've got 5 rivers flowing through it. The Kanye River, Nikko River, you name it. And these rivers take up 1/5 of the whole town. And here's where it gets absolutely wild, guys. So there's this spot where fish would mysteriously gather in winter, right? Like, they just show up in crazy numbers. So the locals were like, that's weird, and decided to dig around. And boom, they discovered hot springs. Not just any hot springs either. These Owari hot springs are literally the only ones in all of Aichi Prefecture to make it into Japan's top 100 famous hot springs list. Talk about striking liquid gold. Now, you're probably wondering about the whole crab thing, right? So apparently, way back in the day, this area was surrounded by water and had tons of crabs living along the shores with willow trees, hence the name Kanyi, literally crab inlet. I mean, nature basically did the branding for them. But here's what really gets my history heart pumping. This place has survived everything. We're talking about a town that's maintained its independent status since 1889. Through the Meiji era, World War II, massive floods, you name it. Most places around it merged or got absorbed by bigger cities, but Kanyi was like, nope, we're good. And speaking of surviving things, they've got this absolutely incredible festival called the Tsunari Festival that's been going for centuries. It's so culturally significant that UNESCO recognized it as an intangible cultural heritage. They've got these amazing decorated boats and traditional ceremonies that'll give you chills. Oh, and can we talk about their food for a second? They've got this dish called inamanju, made from young sea bass, and something called bora zosui, which isn't actually porridge like you'd think, but a rice dish. Plus, they grow these special white figs that are supposedly sweeter than regular ones. The coolest part? This tiny town produced some seriously famous people, like the 24th Prime Minister of Japan, Kato Takaki, spent his childhood there. And get this, the composer who wrote Red Dragonfly, one of Japan's most beloved children's songs, Yamada Kosaku, had family connections to Kanyi and actually composed all their elementary school songs. What really amazes me is how this little place of just 37,000 people has managed to keep its identity while being super close to Nagoya. It's like they found the perfect balance between tradition and modern convenience. You know what? Next week, I'm totally diving into more river towns because this whole water city culture thing is blowing my mind. There's something magical about places that learn to live with water instead of fighting it. Until then, keep exploring history with me. This is Lumi signing off. And remember, the best stories are hiding in the most unexpected places. Hey there, history lovers! It's your girl Lumi here, and oh my god, do I have an absolutely mind-blowing story for you today! We're diving deep into one of Japan's most legendary places, Sekigahara, and trust me, this little town in Gifu Prefecture is like totally packed with more drama than a reality TV show. So first things first, can we talk about how they can't even decide how to spell their own name? Like, seriously, the official town name is Sekigahara with a big K-E. That's K in katakana. But then you've got the highway interchange using Sekigahara with the small ga. That's K. I'm like, guys, pick a lane. It's giving me major indecisive vibes. But here's the kicker. Sekigahara is literally the westernmost place on the main Japanese island that uses either of these characters. Like, they're basically the gatekeepers of the K-E and gay club. How random is that? But, okay, let's get to the juicy stuff, because this place is absolutely dripping with history. Picture this. It's the year 1600, and Japan is about to have the ultimate showdown that will literally change the entire course of the country forever. We're talking about the Battle of Sekigahara, people. This wasn't just any old fight. This was the fight that ended the Sengoku period and put the Tokugawa shogunate in power for the next 2.5 centuries. And the location? Pure genius! Sekigahara sits right between the Ibuki Mountains to the north and the Suzuka Mountain Range to the south. It's like nature created the perfect battlefield amphitheater. For centuries, this has been the place where Eastern and Western Japan meet. Back in ancient times, there was even something called the Fuwa Barrier, one of the 3 major checkpoints in Japan. It's like the ultimate crossroads of destiny. But wait, there's more! Before the famous 1600 battle, Sekigahara was already soaked in historical blood, and I mean that in the most educational way possible. The Jinshin War of 672 AD also went down here. That's like over 900 years before the Tokugawa Showdown. This place has been the stage for epic conflicts since way back when people were still figuring out how to use chopsticks properly. Now, let's talk about something that'll blow your mind. The weather in this place is absolutely bonkers. Get this, it's technically in a heavy snowfall zone because of these crazy seasonal winds called Ibuki Oroshi that blow in from Wakasa Bay. The record snowfall? 91 centimeters in 2022. That's like up to your waist if you're my height. But then, and this is where it gets wild, the highest temperature ever recorded was 37.9 degrees Celsius. That's like 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So basically, Sekigahara is out here living its best life as both a winter wonderland and a summer scorcher. Talk about having range! And here's something that made me literally laugh out loud when I read it. This town has had 12 mayors since 1928, and like half of them couldn't handle the job. One guy quit because he couldn't figure out where to put the garbage dump. Another one stepped down because he got sick. Then there was this poor dude who quit over some merger drama. I'm like, being mayor of Sekigahara is apparently harder than surviving the actual Battle of Sekigahara. The current mayor has been hanging in there since 2012, though, so props to him for breaking the curse. But you know what's absolutely incredible? This tiny town with barely 6,600 people has gone international. They've got sister battlefield agreements with Gettysburg in Pennsylvania and Waterloo in Belgium. Like, how cool is that? They literally formed a club of famous battlefields. I can just imagine the meetings. Hey, so we all had these massive historical battles that changed everything. Wanna be friends? It's like the most unique friendship ever. The Gettysburg connection is particularly sweet because both battles ended civil wars and brought peace to their countries. It's like they bonded over being the places where everyone finally said, "Okay, enough fighting, let's figure this out." The fact that a little Japanese town and American Civil War battlefield are now buddies gives me all the feels. And here's my favorite random fact. Sekigahara is literally where East meets West in Japan, and I'm not just talking historically, this is where the flavor boundary line runs. The cup noodles taste different on either side of town. Like, you can literally drive from one end to the other and experience a complete culinary culture shift. They stock both Eastern and Western style products because they can't decide which side of Japan they belong to. It's like being the ultimate middle child of Japanese geography. The town also has these amazing historical sites scattered everywhere. You've got Sasao Mountain where Ishida Mitsunari set up his position, Tohai Mountain where Tokugawa Ieyasu started, and Matsuo Mountain where Kobayakawa Hideaki was being all dramatic and indecisive about which side to join. It's like a real-life board game where you can walk around and visit all the strategic positions. What gets me emotional, though, is thinking about how this one battle on October 15, 1600 lasted only about 6 hours, but determined Japan's fate for centuries. Like, imagine if your whole country's future was decided in less time than it takes to binge-watch a season of your favorite show. The weight of history in this place is just wow! So there you have it. Lovely listeners, Sekigahara, the tiny town that's basically the main character of Japanese history, from ancient barriers to epic battles, from mayors who can't stick around to international battlefield friendships, from record snowfall to scorching summers, this place has literally everything. Next time you're slurping different flavored cup noodles, just remember, somewhere in Sekigahara, they're stocking both versions because they're too historically important to pick sides. Stay curious, stay awesome, and I'll catch you next time on Lumi's History Hour. Hey there, history lovers! It's your girl, Lumi! And oh my gosh, do I have a story for you today? Like, seriously, when I first read about this little town called Shingu Machi in Fukuoka, I literally dropped my textbook. And trust me, that's saying something because I never let go of my history books. So picture this. You've got this sleepy little town that's been chilling with around 10,000 people for, like, forever. Then, bam! The 2010s hit, and suddenly it's like someone pressed fast forward on the entire place. We're talking about a population explosion that would make fireworks jealous. Get this, in 2015, Shingu Machi had the highest population growth rate in all of Japan at 22.9%. That's like if your friend group suddenly tripled overnight and you're standing there like, where did all these people come from? The only place that beat them was Chiyoda Ward in Tokyo, but let's be real, that's Tokyo, they're basically cheating. But here's where it gets absolutely bonkers, and I mean this in the best way possible. This town became the ultimate furniture battleground. Like, imagine if IKEA, Nitori, Sakoda, Tokyo Interior, and a bunch of home improvement stores all decided to have the most epic showdown ever. They literally turned Shingu Machi into what I'm calling the Furniture Wars of Kyushu. IKEA came in first, their very first Kyushu location, and everyone else was like, oh no you didn't! So they all set up shop right there. Now you've got Kainz, Nafco, Konan. It's like a Swedish meatball versus Japanese efficiency deathmatch, and honestly, the residents are winning because, hello, shopping options. And can we talk about the age thing for a second? This place has more kids than grandparents. 20.8% under 14, only 18.4% over 65. It's like a real-life Benjamin Button situation, but for an entire town. Most places in Japan are going gray, but Shingu Machi is basically the fountain of youth in municipal form. But wait, there's more. The historical nerd in me is absolutely screaming because this place has the Yoruusu archaeological site, the type site for Yoruusu pottery. That means when archaeologists found this specific style of ancient pottery elsewhere, they literally named it after this spot. It's like being the person who invented pizza and having everyone call it Your Name Pizza forever. Oh, and here's my favorite random fact. They almost had a train station way earlier. But get this, the town elder said no! They were probably like, we don't need no stinking trains! Fast forward to 2010, and they're like, actually, we do need that train. Sometimes you gotta love how history comes full circle. The commuter situation is wild too. Almost 44% of people living there work in Fukuoka City. It's basically become the ultimate bedroom community. Everyone sleeping in Shingu Machi and working in the big city. Smart move, honestly. You know what really gets me though? They've got udon shop wars too. Apparently, there are so many udon places that local TV shows do special features on the competition. Like, imagine your biggest life decision being which udon shop to choose for lunch. And that island, Inoshima, just chilling offshore like a little piece of paradise. They've got their own ferry service and everything. It's giving me major secret hideaway vibes. The merger drama is also pretty juicy. They keep talking about joining Fukuoka City, but every time someone brings it up, residents are like, nah, we're good being our own thing, thanks. Classic small town independence right there. Honestly, Shingu Machi is like that friend who was quiet in middle school and then showed up to high school absolutely glowing up in every possible way. Population boom, furniture empire, historical significance, beach access, mountain views, this place literally has it all. That's all for today's deep dive, History Fam. Remember, the past isn't just about dusty old books. Sometimes it's about Swedish furniture stores having epic battles in small Japanese towns. Until next time, keep digging into those historical gems. This is Lumi, signing off. Hey there, history lovers! It's your girl, Lumi, here, and oh my gosh, do I have an absolutely mind-blowing city to share with you today! We're diving deep into Ichinomiya City in Aichi Prefecture, and trust me, this place is, like, totally amazing. So first things first, the name Ichinomiya literally means first shrine, and that's because this city is home to Masumida Shrine, which was the most important shrine in the entire Owari region. Like, Imagine being the shrine that everyone looked up to. Talk about pressure, right? But seriously, this shrine has been the heart of the city for over 1,000 years, and the whole town basically grew up around it as a temple town. That's what I call having serious historical street cred. But here's where it gets super fascinating. Ichinomiya became famous for something totally different. Textiles. And not just any textiles, but some of the world's finest wool. The Bishu region, where Ichinomiya sits, is literally one of the 3 major wool production areas in the entire world. Can you believe that? This little Japanese city is competing with places in Europe and making some of the most luxurious fabrics that end up in high-end fashion brands globally. Now, here's something that made me laugh. Back in the day, they called Ichinomiya the City of Female Workers because all these textile factories employed tons of women. And get this, the female workers were nicknamed Oriheim, which means weaving princesses. Like, how cute is that? These ladies were out there making beautiful fabrics and got called princesses for it. Even today, there are still more women living in the city because of this historical connection. Girl power through the ages, am I right? The textile history goes way, way back too. We're talking Heian period, like over 1,000 years ago. They were already producing gorgeous silk brocades back then, but the real boom came during the Meiji era when they got into wool production. There was this period called the Gachaman boom, where business was so good that you could literally hear the sound of weaving machines and spinning wheels echoing throughout the entire city. Just imagine walking down the street and hearing this symphony of textile production. That's the sound of prosperity right there. But wait, there's more. You know, Koko Ichibanya, that curry chain that's literally everywhere in Japan? Yeah, that started right here in Ichinomiya. The company Ichibanya is headquartered in this city, so basically every time you eat their curry, you're tasting a little piece of Ichinomiya history. How cool is that? And speaking of food culture, Ichinomiya claims to be the birthplace of morning service. You know, that awesome Japanese coffee culture where you order coffee and get free toast and eggs? That supposedly started here. They're so proud of it, they even have Ichinomiya morning promotional activities. I mean, starting a whole cultural phenomenon around breakfast. That's what I call leaving your mark on history. The city has about 370,000 people now, making it the 4th largest city in Aichi Prefecture after Toyota, Toyohashi, and Okazaki. It officially became a core city in 2021, which is pretty recent. They've been growing by merging with neighboring areas. In 2005, they absorbed Bisai City and Kisogawa Town, which really boosted their population. One of the coolest landmarks is Twin Arch 138, this massive observation tower that's 138 meters tall. Get it? 138, because the tower's in area code 138. Sometimes Japanese naming conventions are just so perfectly logical, it makes me giggle. They also have one of Japan's 3 major Tanabata festivals. Every July, over 1.3 million people flood into the city for this star festival celebration. It started back in 1956 and has become this absolutely massive summer event. Like, imagine your hometown festival bringing in over 1 million visitors. That's some serious festival game. The city has produced some incredible people, too, like baseball legend Yamauchi Kazuhiro, who played for the Chunichi Dragons, and tons of entertainers, including voice actors and musicians. There's even this unique local bon dance tradition where they sing along to Dancing Hero by Ogino Megumi with special local lyrics about monkeys, only in Japan, right? What really gets me excited is how this city perfectly represents Japan's industrial evolution, from ancient shrine town to medieval textile center to modern manufacturing hub and now a bedroom community for Nagoya. It's like watching centuries of Japanese history play out in one location. So, there you have it, folks. Ichinomiya City, where ancient shrines meet modern industry, where weaving princesses created textile empires, and where your morning coffee culture was born. Until next time, keep exploring history. Hey everyone, it's your girl Lumi here, and oh my gosh, do I have the most incredible story for you today. We're diving into Tenjin, which is basically like the Times Square of Japan, but with way more history and way cooler underground shopping. So picture this. You're in Fukuoka, and there's this absolutely massive entertainment district called Tenjin. Like, we're talking Kyushu's biggest party zone here, people. But here's the thing that absolutely blows my mind. This place used to be literally nothing but swamps and burial grounds. Can you imagine? From swamp to shopping paradise. The name Tenjin comes from this amazing guy named Sugawara Michizane. Now, this dude was like the Einstein of ancient Japan, super smart scholar who got totally screwed over by politics. He died in exile, and then, get this, people thought his angry spirit was causing all sorts of natural disasters. So they were like, okay, we'll build you a shrine and call you a god. Smart move, honestly. But wait, it gets better. In the Edo period, this area was just part of Fukuoka Castle's town, and all the real action was happening in Hakata. Tenjin was basically the boring government district where all the samurai lived. Then, boom, Meiji Restoration happens, and suddenly all these warrior families just disappear. The area becomes this weird ghost town. Here's where it gets absolutely wild. In 1936, this department store called Iwataya opens up, just one store, and everyone's like, "Are you crazy? Nobody comes to Tenjin." But plot twist, it becomes the biggest department store in all of Kyushu. Talk about a glow-up. Now here's my favorite part, and this is where it gets really crazy. Tenjin can't build super tall skyscrapers because of Fukuoka Airport. The planes literally fly right over the shopping district. So while every other major city in Japan has these massive towers, Tenjin's stuck at about 67 meters high. It's like having a height limit in a video game. But the city was like, "Hold my sake," and created this thing called Tenjin Big Bang. No, they're not blowing anything up. They're basically using special legal loopholes to build taller buildings. Some areas can now go up to 115 meters. It's like they found a cheat code. The underground scene is absolutely insane, too. There's this massive underground shopping street that connects everything. You could literally live down there. It's like a whole city beneath the city. So cool! And get this. The population of actual Tenjin is only about 1,800 people. That's smaller than my high school, but millions of people visit every year. It's like this tiny residential area that happens to be surrounded by the biggest party zone in Kyushu. The transformation is just mind-blowing, from samurai ghost town to modern metropolis in less than a century, and they did it all while planes are flying overhead. If that's not the most Japanese thing ever, I don't know what is. Next time you're planning a trip to Japan, definitely check out Tenjin. Walk around and think about all those samurai who used to live there, probably never imagining their neighborhood would become this incredible shopping and entertainment paradise. History is literally everywhere. That's all for today's show, guys. Keep exploring, keep learning, and remember, every place has an amazing story if you just dig deep enough. This is Lumi signing off. Hey, welcome back to History That Hits Different. I'm Lumi, and oh my gosh, do I have some absolutely mind-blowing stuff for you today about Maple Ridge. Like, seriously, this place is giving me all the historical feels, and I cannot even. So picture this. It's 1874, right? Like, way before TikTok, before cars, before literally everything we know today. And these absolute legends decide to incorporate Maple Ridge as a municipality on September 12th. But here's the kicker. There were only 50 families. 50. That's like one decent-sized high school reunion, and they're out here creating British Columbia's fifth oldest municipality. The audacity. I love it. And can we talk about how extra they were with the land? 33,000 acres for 50 families. That's like giving each family their own personal kingdom. Meanwhile, I can barely get my own bedroom to myself. But whatever. I'm not bitter about living in 2024 or anything. But wait, it gets better. The downtown area used to be called Haney, which honestly sounds like someone's really chill uncle who always brings the best snacks to family gatherings. Oh, that's just Uncle Haney. He's got the good stuff. And speaking of names, they didn't officially become a city until 2014. 2014, that's like practically yesterday in history terms. I was probably learning my multiplication tables when these people were finally like, "You know what? Maybe we should upgrade from district municipality to city." Only took them 140 years to figure that out. Now here's where it gets absolutely fascinating, and I mean drop your textbook fascinating, the cultural diversity of this place throughout history. Like, you've got Finnish families settling in Albion and Webster's Corners, bringing their sauna culture and probably the best meatballs you've ever tasted. Then there's Kanaka Creek, which was originally a community for Kanaka employees of Fort Langley. That's some serious multicultural history happening way before multiculturalism was even a buzzword. And Port Hammond, oh my goodness. Port Hammond had these adorable cottage-like mill houses built by the local mill for workers. Can you imagine your boss literally building you a cute little house? These days, bosses barely want to provide decent coffee in the break room. But here's what absolutely sent me into full history nerd mode. This place has been a movie star since the 70s. Remember Rambo? Yeah, that Rambo. They filmed scenes there. From Rambo to the X-Files to Smallville, Maple Ridge has been serving Hollywood realness for decades. It's like the ultimate background character that steals every scene. Speaking of stealing scenes, let's talk about the legendary athletes this place has produced. Larry Walker, Hall of Fame baseball player. Cam Neely, Hockey Hall of Fame. These aren't just good players. These are legends with plaques and everything. And Tyler O'Neill, who's currently crushing it in Major League Baseball. Plus, there's this racing driver, Greg Moore. May he rest in peace, who was absolutely incredible before his tragic accident. The weather data is honestly hilarious if you're into that kind of thing. And trust me, weather history can be surprisingly dramatic. The record high was 36.5 degrees Celsius in July, which is like 97.7 Fahrenheit for my American listeners. But the record low? -17.5 Celsius. That's like -0.5 Fahrenheit. This place has more temperature mood swings than a teenager, which, as a teenager, I can totally relate to. And can we appreciate that they have one of the longest-running agricultural fairs in British Columbia? Country Fest at the fairgrounds? There's something so beautifully timeless about a community coming together for an agricultural fair. It's like technology changes, fashion changes, but people will always want to show off their prize-winning pumpkins and argue about whose pie is better. The demographics are fascinating, too. From 89% European ancestry in 2001 to 73% in 2021, showing how beautifully diverse this community has become. That's living history, people. That's a community transforming and growing while keeping its roots. So next time someone tries to tell you that small towns are boring, you tell them about Maple Ridge. From Hollywood sets to Hall of Fame athletes, from multicultural pioneers to modern-day mayors, this place has been writing history for 150 years and counting. That's all for today's history that hits different. Keep exploring, keep questioning, and remember, history is literally everywhere if you just know where to look. I'm Lumi, signing off. Hey there, history lovers! It's your girl, Lumi, and oh my gosh, do I have a story for you today. We're talking about Banff, and no, not the one in Scotland, though that's where our story kind of starts. Plot twist. So picture this. It's 1884, and some fancy railroad president named George Stephen is sitting there like, you know what? I'm going to name this gorgeous Canadian mountain town after my Scottish birthplace. Classic move, George, like when I named my hamster Toronto because I was homesick. Except, you know, slightly more historically significant. But here's where it gets absolutely wild. And I mean wild. Three railroad workers in 1883 are just doing their thing, probably complaining about the cold, when bam, they stumble upon natural hot springs. Can you imagine? You're freezing your butt off building a railway, and suddenly you find nature's own jacuzzi. Talk about employee benefits. The government was like, hold up, this is gold. Not literal gold, but tourism gold. They created a 26-square-kilometer reserve around these hot springs faster than I can finish a history textbook, which is saying something because I devour those things. This became Canada's first national park. The first. Banff basically invented the concept of let's preserve this gorgeous place so future generations can Instagram it. Now here's something that'll make your jaw drop. Banff has the most ridiculous temperature extremes. The record low? -51.2 degrees Celsius. That's colder than my ex-boyfriend's heart. But then in 2021, it hit 37.8 degrees during that crazy heat wave. That's a temperature swing of almost 90 degrees. Mother Nature in Banff is basically having mood swings worse than me during finals week. Speaking of extremes, let's talk about Norman Luxton. This guy was literally called Mr. Banff. He published newspapers, built hotels, founded museums, organized festivals. Basically, he was the original influencer before social media existed. This man was out here building an empire while the rest of us can barely manage our Instagram stories. But wait, there's more drama! During World War I, they actually had an internment camp at Banff, where Ukrainian immigrants were imprisoned and forced to build park infrastructure. That's some heavy history that doesn't make it into the tourism brochures. It's a reminder that even the most beautiful places have complicated pasts. And get this, in 1976, astronomers named a crater on Mars after Banff. So now there's literally a piece of Mars with the same name as this mountain town. How cool is that? I'm out here struggling to get my name on the honor roll, and Banff's got real estate on another planet. Today, Banff's population is over 8,000 people living in just 4 square kilometers. That's more cramped than my locker. But Parks Canada actually controls who can live there. You have to prove you work in the community. It's like the world's most exclusive club, except instead of velvet ropes, they've got mountain peaks. The town hosted the Winter Deaflympics in 1991, the first and only Deaflympics ever held in Canada. They also have this epic bike route that starts in Banff and goes all the way to New Mexico. That's over 4,000 kilometers. I get tired walking to the mailbox. So there you have it, folks. Banff, where Scottish nostalgia meets Canadian hot springs, where temperatures swing harder than a playground, and where you need permission just to call it home. From accidental discovery to Mars naming rights, this place has more plot twists than my favorite historical dramas. Next time you're soaking in those hot springs, remember, you're basically doing exactly what those railroad workers did in 1883, except with better Instagram opportunities. This has been Lumi, reminding you that history is everywhere, even in the most unexpected hot tubs. Peace out, history nerds! Hey there, history lovers! Welcome back to the History Files. I'm your host, Lumi. And oh my gosh, do I have a story for you today! We're talking about the Canadian Pacific Railway, and trust me, this is way more exciting than watching paint dry on a train car. So picture this. It's 1871, and British Columbia is basically like that friend who says they'll only come to your party if you pick them up. Except instead of a ride across town, they wanted an entire railway across the continent. The deal was simple. Build us a railroad to connect with the rest of Canada, or we're not joining Confederation. Talk about high maintenance. Enter John A. MacDonald, and no, not the McDonald's guy, though he probably would have made a fortune selling burgers to railway workers. This prime minister had what they called the National Dream, connecting Canada coast to coast with iron rails. Ambitious? Absolutely. Crazy? Maybe a little. Expensive? Oh, you bet. But here's where it gets juicy. The Pacific Scandal of 1873. MacDonald got caught taking bribes, and honestly, the drama was better than any reality TV show. Politicians getting kicked out of office, contracts getting canceled. It was political chaos with a capital C. Then came the real hero of our story, William Cornelius Van Horn. This guy was like the ultimate project manager on steroids. In 1882, he promised to build 800 kilometers of track in 1 year. People thought he was absolutely bonkers, but you know what? He nearly did it. 672 kilometers plus sidings and branch lines. Not bad for someone everyone thought was totally crazy. Now, let's talk about the workers, because this is where the story gets really heavy. Thousands of Chinese laborers were brought in, and their treatment was absolutely horrific. They were paid between 75 cents and $1.25 a day. And get this, they were paid in rice mats. Meanwhile, they were doing the most dangerous jobs, working with explosives to blast through mountains. Historians estimate between 600 and 800 Chinese workers died building this railway. That's not just a statistic. Those were real people with families and dreams. But wait, there's more drama. By 1883, the railway company was basically broke. Like, seriously running out of money. The government had to step in with $22.5 million in loans. That's like... well, I can't even imagine having that much money in my piggy bank. Then came the Northwest Rebellion in 1885, and Van Horn was like, hold my coffee, I've got this. He transported troops to suppress the rebellion in just 10 days, using incomplete sections of track. Talk about improvising under pressure. Finally, November 7th, 1885, the golden moment. The last spike was driven at Craigellachie, British Columbia. Donald Smith, later known as Lord Strathcona, hammered in that final spike, and boom! Canada was connected coast to coast. 4 years late, but hey, better late than never, right? And can we talk about how they chose their logo? They picked a beaver to honor Donald Smith, who had worked in the beaver fur trade. I mean, of all the animals they could have chosen, bears, eagles, moose, they went with the beaver. Honestly, that's so Canadian, it hurts. The railway wasn't just about moving people in freight, though. They had these incredible silk trains that carried millions of dollars worth of silk from Vancouver to New York. These trains had their own armed guards and had priority over everything. Even passenger trains had to pull into sidings to let the silk trains pass. Imagine being late for your date because a silk train went by. Today, after merging with Kansas City Southern in 2023, the railway operates as Canadian Pacific Kansas City, connecting three countries with over 20,000 kilometers of track. From those first difficult years with Chinese workers dying in mountain passes to luxury holiday trains spreading Christmas cheer, the CPR has been part of Canada's story for over a century and a half. That's all for today's History Files. Remember, history isn't just dusty old facts. It's real people doing extraordinary things, making mistakes, dreaming big, and sometimes succeeding beyond their wildest imagination. Until next time, keep exploring the past. Hey there, history lovers! It's your girl, Lumi, and oh my goodness, do I have a treat for you today! We're talking about Lake Louise in Canada, and I'm literally bouncing in my chair because this place is so cool! So picture this. You're standing at 5,200 feet above sea level. That's like really, really high up. Lake Louise is literally Canada's highest community, which means these people are basically living in the clouds. I mean, talk about having your head in the clouds, am I right? But here's where it gets absolutely fascinating. Before Europeans showed up, the indigenous Nakota people called this place Ho-run-num-ne, which means Lake of the Little Fishes. Like, how adorable is that? These people were out here hunting bison, elk, and moose while I can barely catch my cat when she's being naughty. Now get ready for this name confusion saga that's honestly more dramatic than my dating life. In 1882, this railway worker named Tom Wilson gets taken to the lake by a Nakota guide, and he's like, "Oh wow, this is so pretty. I'm gonna call it Emerald Lake." But wait, there's more. The settlement then became Holt City, which sounds like some fancy shopping mall, doesn't it? Then they changed it again to Lagan. I can't even pronounce that properly. Finally, they settled on Lake Louise, named after Princess Louise, Duchess of Argyle. Girl went through more name changes than I go through crushes. Speaking of the railway, can we talk about how this whole place basically exists because of trains? The Canadian Pacific Railway was building through Bow Valley in the 1870s. And boom, Lake Louise became this railway outpost in 1884. They even built a station in 1910 that's still around today as a restaurant. Like, imagine eating dinner where people used to wait for trains over a century ago. That's some serious historical dining right there. But y'all, the weather here is absolutely insane. We're talking subarctic climate with temperatures that can drop to minus 58 degrees Fahrenheit in winter. That's so cold, I can't even... Like, that's colder than my ex's heart. And get this, they only get 14 frost-free days per year. 14! I complain when it's chilly for a week. The population is wild, too. It's gone up and down like a roller coaster. In 1956, only 56 people lived there. Then by 1986, it jumped to 688. That's like going from a small classroom to a whole school. Most residents are tourism workers who come and go, which honestly sounds like the ultimate seasonal job. Work in paradise, then escape before the brutal winter hits. What really gets me is how this tiny hamlet became this massive international destination. It was added to Rocky Mountains Park in 1892, and now it's right by the Trans-Canada Highway, making it super accessible. It's like they accidentally created the perfect tourist trap just by building a railway station. The climate data is absolutely bonkers. They get almost 280 centimeters of snow annually. That's like 9 feet of snow. Meanwhile, I'm over here complaining about a 2-inch snowfall, and snow can happen any month of the year. Imagine planning a July barbecue and getting snowed on. What I love most about Lake Louise's story is how it represents this incredible meeting of cultures and progress. You've got indigenous peoples who lived there for thousands of years, calling it the Lake of Little Fishes, then European settlers rolling in with their railway dreams, constantly renaming everything like they couldn't make up their minds. And honestly, sitting at 1,600 meters elevation in the middle of the Canadian Rockies, Lake Louise is living its best life as Canada's highest community. These people are literally on top of the world, dealing with weather that would make polar bears shiver, but they're surrounded by some of the most gorgeous scenery on Earth. So next time you're complaining about your commute or your weather, just remember the folks in Lake Louise, living their sky-high dreams with 14 frost-free days and enough snow to build an army of snowmen. That's all for today's historical adventure. Keep exploring, keep learning, and keep that curiosity alive.